อบเรื่องสามI don't know how to mute the laptop fan. Anybody have a suggestion, let me know. Okay. I'll hang in there then. Well, this class, I thought we'd start talking about the historical era after the founding era, where there was this ongoing political battle over economic nationalism. And after Hamilton died, the mantra was espoused and the mantle was picked up by Henry Clay and Daniel Webster and people like John Marshall, who was the Chief Justice of the United States for 33 years, Joseph Story, who was also a Justice of the United States on the Supreme Court, but primarily Henry Clay. He was the political leader of the economic nationalists, and I was just looking at one of the books on Clay, and this is called Henry Clay, The Essential American. It was published not too long ago, about a year or two ago, and it gives a good overview of Clay's career, and it says that, approvingly, it says, the authors say that what he was interested in achieving is economic self-sufficiency, national self-sufficiency, which I mentioned in the last class, which would be autarky, A-U-T-A-R-K-Y, autarky. And this is a very bad idea because it would isolate the country from the international division of labor under the false pretense that you could conceivably produce everything here that you possibly needed without engaging in trade with anybody else around the world. It was this belief that the Nazis adopted in the 20th century, and it is also the main reason why they decided to start conquering all their neighbors, because economic self-sufficiency, they realized, could not be achieved with the meager resources of Germany alone, that they had to have resource water especially, and other types of natural resources had to be acquired from other countries, and so that led to war. And so, it's a very bad idea, but it was always at the heart of the whole idea of the so-called American system. And that phrase was coined by Hamilton, but Henry Clay is most associated with it. There's even a book entitled Henry Clay and the American System, even though it was Hamilton's idea. So Clay was the leader of the bringing forward of these Hamiltonian ideas. And so in terms of history, the one thing that Hamilton did get was the Bank of the United States. And the Bank of the United States was the first central bank, and it's known as the first Bank of the United States, 1791. And it immediately, within 5 years, created 72% price inflation. And it was given a 20-year charter, and when the 20 years was up, the U.S. Congress did not renew the charter, because the bank did exactly what Jefferson and the Jeffersonians said it would do. It created boom and bust cycles, and it corrupted politics by offering cheap credit to political supporters, for example, of the bank and of the economic nationalists. It was even used to fund the political campaigns of proponents of the bank and opponents of Jefferson. And so corruption and boom and bust cycles and price inflation were exactly what were predicted by people like John Taylor and Jefferson, and so it was defunded. And then the War of 1812 came, and the war was used as an excuse to bring back the bank to help pay off the war debt. And so the bank was resurrected in January of 1817, and it led to the Panic of 1819. Back in those days, depressions were called panics, and so it created a boom and bust cycle. It inflated the currency, created false prosperity, and the bubble that was created burst, and Murray Rothbard wrote his doctoral dissertation at Columbia University in the 1950s under the title, The Panic of 1819. And so if you read A History of Money and Banking in the United States by Murray Rothbard, you can read all about this episode, because it was based on his doctoral research at Columbia University and on his own book. And so the bank was brought back into being, Hamilton's Bank, and it did the same thing. It created boom and bust cycles, and it created political corruption. In my book, The Real Lincoln, I quote Henry Clay himself. As in the 1820s, he resigned as Secretary of State so that he could become a general counsel of the Bank of the United States. He could become the lawyer for the Bank of the United States. And so, and he did. And the reason was he was a gambler, and he had around $50,000 in gambling debt in that day's money. And so he became the general counsel, the lawyer, the paid lawyer, sort of on a consulting basis for the Bank of the United States. And he made more than enough money to pay off all his gambling debts. And in today's money, that would be over $1 million. And so that's how Henry Clay came to own a large plantation named Ashland that exists to this day at some kind of museum. He was on the take from the banks. His political associate, Daniel Webster, I quote in my book, The Real Lincoln, is writing a letter to the president of the Bank of the United States, Nicholas Biddle, was his name, B-I-D-B-L-E, saying, threatening, saying that if you want my relationship to the bank to continue, send me my retainer. So he was literally on a retainer, a very healthy retainer too, to provide political support for the continuation of this bank. And so these men benefited and profited personally from this bank. It wasn't only an ideological thing, it wasn't only a public policy issue, but they personally pocketed a lot of money through corruption, which of course is exactly the type of thing Hamilton intended, as we discussed last week. And so the Bank of the United States, after it came in back into being, the second bank, it doubled the price level after creating the Panic of 1819 and creating the boom and bust cycle. And there was a big bust. And the Panic of 1819 was the first really big, massive depression. In some cities, there was something like a loss in 3/4 of the job, of manufacturing jobs in Philadelphia, for example, that happened as a result of this. And so as time went on, by the time you get into the late 1820s, President Andrew Jackson became the nemesis of the Bank of the United States, and he eventually defunded the Bank of the United States. He vetoed the bill, the legislation that would have rechartered the Bank of the United States for another 20 years, and so the Bank of the United States eventually just went out of business as a depository of tax funds. And Andrew Jackson had a lot of help, though. He had a lot of help from politicians in a lot of states, north and south. State of Ohio was the most notorious, where the Bank of the United States opened up two branches in the state of Ohio, and the state of Ohio imposed a tax of $50,000 a year on each branch. And so the Bank of the United States refused to pay. And when they refused to pay, the state of Ohio sent armed marshals into the bank to retrieve the money, which they did. So they literally robbed the bank of $100,000. And other states did something similar. Maryland, the state of Maryland did something similar. And this led to a Supreme Court case called McCulloch versus Maryland. And this is where the Chief Justice Marshall, who was a proponent of the bank and a true blue Hamiltonian, said in his statement that the power to tax is the power to destroy. What he was referring to is the power of the state of Maryland to tax this government bank was the power to destroy that government bank, and he was certainly right about that. And so he issued the opinion that the Bank of the United States is constitutional. Andrew Jackson responded with an opinion of his own, essentially saying, "Thanks, Mr. Marshall, for your opinion, but my opinion is different. And we have three branches of government, not one, in the United States. And my opinion is just as important as your opinion on this matter and on all other constitutional matters for that matter." And so he essentially thumbed his nose at John Marshall, and Congress did not have the votes to sustain, to get rid of the veto. So the veto was sustained and prevailed, and the Bank of the United States went kaput. And it wasn't really resurrected until the Lincoln administration had the National Currency Acts, which went a long way toward nationalizing the money supply with the creation of the greenback dollar and the Legal Tender Act. But we didn't get another government-run bank until the Fed in 1913. And so it's an interesting story of the whole struggle, a political struggle for economic nationalism that colors American history. Another important part of that struggle was the struggle over free trade versus protectionism. That was the second plank of the so-called American system, protectionist tariffs. And the United States had an increase in the tariff rate in the year 1816. And the reason given for it by some of the politicians who voted for it, like John C. Calhoun, was that there had been an embargo placed on international trade by James Madison and Jefferson because the British were kidnapping American sailors and conscripting them and confiscating American ships to help them in their war against France. And so rather than have another war with England, Jefferson thought that a trade embargo would be a second best solution, to use an economic phrase. And these men claimed to have been felt guilty about the harm that they had inflicted on New England, because New England was the epicenter of the shipping industry. And so to benefit New England manufacturers, they threw them a crumb in the form of an increase in tariff rates on imported goods into the United States. And so those are the reasons that they gave. But it wasn't a very, very big tariff. It wasn't a protectionist tariff, really. The first real protectionist tariff came in 1824 and was sponsored by Henry Clay himself. And it raised the average tariff rate from the 15 to 20% range, the average tariff rate on imports, to around 40%, over 40%. And then they're encouraged by that. They created an even bigger tariff on more items in 1828. So that the average tariff rate was up around 45%. To put it into some perspective, today in the U.S. the average rate is around 2% on average. We don't have many protectionist tariffs anymore. The government uses non-tariff forms of protectionism whenever it does that. It tries to block international trade. But this created quite a crisis. It was called the Tariff of Abominations by Southerners, because Southerners, who are mostly involved in agriculture, exported about three-fourths of everything they grew, mostly to Europe and other parts of the world. And so if you're going to restrict trade and restrict commerce, what a tariff does is to impoverish your trading partners. They have to either pay a heavy tariff or they can't trade here and they can't make money here. So therefore, they don't have as much money with which to buy American goods. And so anybody who sold American goods to foreigners was losing a lot of business. And so and the Southerners understood that. You didn't have to be an economic scholar to understand that what economists say is that a tax on imports, which is what a tariff is, eventually turns into a tax on exports, because it impoverishes your trading partners and they cannot buy as much from you. Therefore, your exports go down. You export less. And since American farmers were the main exporters, they were feeling that they were being discriminated against, especially Southern farmers. And so the state of South Carolina actually held a political convention and decided to nullify the Tariff of Abomination, and they declared that they would not collect it. They voted to give the governor of South Carolina $160,000, this is in 1832, with which to purchase guns to fend off federal tax collectors. And they also said that any federal tax collector who came around trying to collect the tariff would have his personal property confiscated and he would be thrown in prison. And so they were serious. There was almost a secession crisis over this at the time. Andrew Jackson was president. He threatened to send warships to enforce the tariff, but he did not. And so they ended up compromising on a lower tariff rate. And so the tariff rate was eventually diminished over the next 10 years, from 1832 to 1842. So that by the time you get to the late 1850s, the average tariff rate was all the way down to the 15% range, 15%. And so that is probably the closest the Americans came to free trade in the whole 19th century. There's a famous book, A Tariff History of the United States by Frank Taussig, spelled T-A-U-S-S-I-G. It's on the Macy's.org web. It covers the history of the American tariff policy up until the late 19th century, early 20th century, and it gives a lot of facts about this whole episode. If anyone is interested in doing any research on the subject, if you're a student, for example. And so we had virtually free trade at the outbreak of the American Civil War, and so Hamilton failed there. The Hamiltonians failed miserably to achieve what they wanted to achieve, the second plank. So by the time you get to the 1840s, or the 1850s, there's no more bank. The bank had been abolished, and there was also no more tariff. And in fact, so the Hamiltonians were on the run. The Federalist Party had disappeared altogether, but it had been replaced by the Whig Party, which advocated the same exact bad ideas, bad economic ideas. And then the third main plank of economic nationalism, of the so-called American system, was what we today call corporate welfare. And corporate welfare was primarily to be in the form of taxpayer-financed subsidies to corporations to build roads, canals, and then eventually railroads. Railroad building in the United States commenced in the 1820s. And so there were always a group of men in politics who wanted to kowtow or pander to corporations who they understood would fund them and their political careers if they could arrange to get taxpayer money to be used for these businesses that could not stand alone, as far as that's concerned. And that's why there's an interesting quote that I used in my Lincoln book, The Real Lincoln, about Henry Clay. And this is a description of Henry Clay in a book on Lincoln by Edgar Lee Masters. The book is entitled Lincoln the Man by Edgar Lee Masters. Edgar Lee Masters was the law partner of Clarence Darrow, who was a famous early 20th century lawyer. He was also a famous poet and playwright. Those of you who are knowledgeable about these things might recognize him as the author of the Spoon River Anthology. But he also wrote this great piece of scholarship called Lincoln the Man. And here's what he says about Henry Clay. Lincoln, by the way, called Henry Clay the beau ideal of a statesman. He claimed that every idea that Abe Lincoln have about politics came from Henry Clay. So he totally idolized and worshipped Henry Clay as his political icon. And here's what Edgar Lee Masters says about Clay. Henry Clay was a champion of that political system which doles favors to the strong in order to win and to keep their adherence to the government. His system offered shelter to devious schemes and corrupt enterprises. He was the beloved son, figuratively speaking, of course, of Alexander Hamilton, with his corrupt funding schemes, his superstitions concerning the advantage of a public debt and a people taxed to make profits for enterprises that cannot stand alone. His example and his doctrines led to the creation of a party that had no platform to announce because its principles were plunder and nothing else, end quote. I suppose it's a good idea to not really announce your platform if your platform is plundering everyone. And I think that is a totally accurate description of Clay and the Whigs and the Whig Party. And of course, there's a big fat book called The History of the American Whig Party by Michael Holt. Michael Holt was a longtime history professor at the University of Virginia. And in that book, he says that and no one was a more forceful proponent of a central bank, that part of the Whig program, than was Abraham Lincoln in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. Okay, and so once Henry Clay died in 1852, Lincoln himself gave a eulogy to Clay from Springfield, Illinois, and he picked up the mantle. He became the political heir of the Hamiltonian tradition. And so the Whigs did fight mightily in the political trenches to adopt this aspect of economic nationalism, but they chose to do it, and mostly at the state government level. There was no hope of getting this done at the federal level because there was too much opposition, and most of the opposition came from southern members of Congress, as did most of opposition to the tariffs and the bank. It was Jeffersonians that were mostly in Virginia, South Carolina, places like that. There were, of course, northern Jeffersonians. They were denigrated and smeared as copperhead snakes during the Civil War years, but they were Jeffersonians. They're in favor of limited constitutional government, laissez-faire economics, and constitutionalism to some degree. But as politicians, of course, none of them was perfect. They were politicians. But most of the opposition to all of these things did come from the South. Not all of it, but most of it. And since the South was so dominant in this area, most of the American presidents up until the 1860s were from the southern states, especially Virginia. They knew that they didn't have much of a chance of getting these things put into place, so they worked at the state government level. And so a lot of states did use tax dollars, state government tax dollars, to fund corporations attempting to build roads and canals, and then eventually railroads to some extent. There wasn't much state funding of railroads. And it was universally a disaster, a financial disaster, in state after state after state. I'll read one quote about what happened in the state of Illinois in the late 1830s. Abe Lincoln was the leader of the Whig Party in Illinois in the late 1830s, and he succeeded in getting the state legislature to spend over $11 million in what we today would call corporate welfare for road and canal building. And here's what Lincoln's law partner, William Herndon, said about the results of all this. He says, I'm quoting, "The gigantic and stupendous operations of the scheme dazzled the eyes of nearly everybody. But in the end, it rolled up a debt so enormous as to impede the otherwise marvelous progress of Illinois. The burdens imposed by this legislature under the guise of improvements became so monumental in size, it is little wonder that at intervals for years afterwards, the monster of debt repudiation often showed its hideous face above the waves of popular indignation." And there's his economic historian named Goodrich, Carter Goodrich, who wrote all about this, wrote several books about this, and he documented that in the 1830s and 40s, and state after state that adopted these policies of corporate welfare for road and canal building, nothing was finished. He concluded in his book, Carter Goodrich, nothing was finished. Not one single road was completed altogether, despite spending many, many millions of dollars all over. And it was such a debacle, that by the time you get to the 1860s, the early 1860s, every single state except Massachusetts had amended its constitution to outlaw the use of tax dollars being given to a corporation to do anything, road building, canal building, or anything else, because it had been such a debacle. Nothing was built. The taxpayers are deep in the debt, massive corruption, much of the money was stolen and just disappeared, and so forth. And so, and of course, whenever these attempts were made to use federal tax dollars, it was a total failure. Jefferson said the Constitution would have to be amended first. James Madison, when he was president, the very last thing he did in office, his last day in office in 1813, was to veto a piece of legislation that included a subsidy for road building in it. James Monroe did the same thing. Andrew Jackson vetoed these bills. And so president after president vetoed this as unconstitutional. And so there was virtually no spending of federal tax money on corporate welfare for roads, canals, or railroads until the Lincoln administration. Then the floodgates opened. And so if you look at the sweep of history in the U.S., the Hamiltonian system, the American system, was quite a failure. One interesting story in terms of the role of Henry Clay here is that when you get to 1840, the year 1840, the Whigs got their man as president, William Henry Harrison, who is my favorite president and also Lou Rockwell's favorite president, because he died 1 month after he was inaugurated, and he couldn't possibly have done much damage. But William Henry Harrison was a Whig. He was a former general, and so the Whigs kept nominating these old war heroes, generals, hoping that the public would vote for them because they were pumped up as a war hero, and then they would sign the legislation for protectionist tariffs, the central bank, and corporate welfare. And so finally, they get their man in office. He won the election. Henry Clay is the domineering figure in the House of Representatives, and so they have all their legislation ready. Harrison dies. His vice president is John Tyler from Virginia, who turned out to be a Jeffersonian and an opponent of all of these things. He was a free trader. He was against a bank run by politicians out of the nation's capital, and he was against corporate welfare. In fact, in the book published by the Independent Institute called Recarving Rushmore by Ivan Eland, E-L-A-N-D, is a ranking of American presidents according to the criterion of how good a job they did in protecting life, liberty, and property, period. That's it. And he ranks John Tyler as the number one president in American history. The history profession, the mainstream of the American history profession, would rank Tyler down near number 50 somewhere because he was against big government. He did not get Americans involved in any wars. He vetoed big spending bills. He vetoed tax increases. And typically when you see these rankings by the mainstream of the American history profession, it's whoever spends the most money and kills the most people in war is the great president. Lincoln, Roosevelt, Wilson, they're always at the top. But if you look at the protection of life, liberty, and property as your criterion, as Ivan Eland does, then you get people like John Tyler being very highly ranked up there. And so, but anyway, he vetoed all of this, and so he was. Henry Clay made it a point to kick him out of the Whig Party. They kicked him out of the Whig Party, and they burned the president in effigy in front of the White House. And so for the rest of his term, he was not. He was without a political party. And so that was the end of it. That was the end of it in terms of any success that the Hamiltonians would have during that era. With the death of William Henry Harrison, it would not be until Abe Lincoln was elected president that they would finally get their way. That's why next week's class is called Hamiltonian Hegemony. And so the strategy had to change. They had worked within the system and had failed in the system. And so so they changed their strategy. So what did they do? Well, there wasn't so much of a change of strategy, but in my opinion, a re-emphasis of a strategy that had been ongoing since the days of Hamilton. And the strategy was to essentially eviscerate the Constitution as any kind of limit on governmental powers. Because, for example, when James Madison vetoed the spending bill on his last day of office, he's known as the father of the U.S. Constitution. One of the things he said was, I cannot put my finger on the part of the Constitution that would allow me to do this. In other words, constitutional arguments were made to say there is no constitutional authority for a bank, regardless of a central bank, regardless of what John Marshall said about it. There is no constitutional authority for protectionist tariffs because the Constitution itself, the original Constitution, called for equal taxation, proportionate taxation based on population, and the protectionist tariff is discriminatory taxation. And the Constitution itself, James Madison said, does not allow for the granting of subsidies to corporations to build roads or anything else. And so part of the strategy was always to effectively not amend the Constitution, but to somehow use case law tall tales by clever lawyers like Alexander Hamilton and Joseph Story and Daniel Webster to essentially change the Constitution without formally amending it, to change the meaning of the Constitution. And so so the economic nationalists went to work at this. And so they had to eviscerate or destroy the Constitution as a limit on governmental power and turn it into a document that would be nothing more than a rubber stamp on just about anything the government would ever want to do. That was always Hamilton's position of the usefulness of this Constitution, to be a rubber stamp on unlimited government. Just the opposite of the Jeffersonian view of constitutions. And so we talked about Hamilton. I mean, Hamilton was the, last week, he was the inventor of the idea of implied powers of the Constitution. He was first to lay out an argument for why the general welfare clause of the Constitution can, in theory, be used to justify almost anything the government does. He was the first, or among the first, to pervert the Commerce Clause of the Constitution to allow the government to get involved in economic regulation much more than what is allowed by the actual document itself. And his one of his chief allies was John Marshall, the Chief Justice. And so Marshall was appointed in 1801, and he took office in 1801, along with the same year Jefferson became president. And Marshall just idolized Hamilton. He was a Hamiltonian through and through. In fact, John Marshall's statement that the Bank of the United States was constitutional literally was used long sections of Hamilton's report on the constitutionality of a bank, verbatim, word for word. He plugged it in there. And so he's quite worshipful of Hamilton. And he, in the course of his career, John Marshall repeated all of Hamilton's lies about the Constitution, all of his attempts to subvert the Constitution. John Marshall invented the idea of judicial review, for example. Those words did not appear in the Constitution. And this was his attempt to say that I, John Marshall, will tell you what is and is not constitutional, being the Chief Justice. But of course, the original idea of the American government system was that there are three branches, legislative, judicial, and executive. And on top of that, there are the sovereign states. The Tenth Amendment says that, there are certain powers given to the central government by Article 1, Section 8, but all else, everything else is reserved to the citizens respectively, the people respectively, and the states. And so there's four different areas there. The people and the states, the legislature, the national legislature, the executive branch, and the judiciary. And the basic thinking of the Jeffersonians was always just that, that we don't allow everyone's liberty to be decided upon by one man or five government lawyers with lifetime tenure, the majority of the Supreme Court. But that was Marshall's idea. Marshall also invented the notion that the federal government, through its judiciary, could veto or overturn the decisions of state court decisions. That's not in the Constitution. This was made up by John Marshall, and it stuck. John Marshall also repeated the lie that was put out there by Hamilton that said that the states were never sovereign. Although, as I mentioned last time, the U.S. Constitution was ratified by political conventions at the state level. It says so in Article 7 of the Constitution. And so, contrary to the document itself and contrary to the plain record of history, people like Hamilton and Marshall thought that if they repeated this story long enough, they could probably get enough Americans to believe it. And it still is repeated to this day. And so he spread that lie that the states, citizens of the states were never sovereign, and somehow the central government on itself was all-powerful. And Marshall was also the first to invent the fiction that the so-called Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution gives the federal government supreme power over all states and all people. And the Constitution is called the supreme law of the land in the document. However, in that passage, it is only referring to the functions of government delegated to the central government by the states in Article 1, Section 8. Article 1, Section 8 says these are the things the federal government has a right to do, and those things it is supreme. Foreign policy, for example. We don't have the state of Florida does not have its own foreign policy. The state of Massachusetts does not have its own foreign policy. You're supreme in that, but nothing else. The Tenth Amendment says everything else is the prerogative of the people in the states. Marshall was the first to begin perverting the meaning of the Supremacy Clause to to say that the federal government was always and everywhere supreme over everyone and everything. And of course, that would lead to a sort of a Nazi-like tyranny. That's no different than that, from that type of thinking than anything any totalitarian during the 20th century said about their ideal form of government. And Marshall had a lot of help. He had Joseph Story was another Supreme Court justice who wrote a famous book called Commentaries on the Constitution, and he repeated all the same things, you know, the fiction about the Supremacy Clause. Another fiction that he invented was the lie that the Constitution was ratified by what he called the whole people. It never was. It went state by state from political conventions. That's how it was ratified. There was never any national plebiscite, national election, or vote on the Constitution. It was state by state. And besides that, women did not have the right to vote at that time. They didn't get the right to vote until 1920. Free blacks did not have the right to vote anywhere at that time, and certainly not slaves. And so even the words, the whole people, make no sense in that regard. But again, I think these men thought if they repeated this fiction long enough, enough people will believe it to be snowed over. And this is repeated to this day. If you listen to a lot of the so-called neoconservatives, who are known as Straussians, Harry Jaffa, people and his followers, the so-called Straussians, whenever they touch upon this issue of centralization of governmental power, they use this language of the whole people, which comes from Joseph Story and Daniel Webster. So it's a long history of this big lie about American political history. And also, another thing that Joseph Story did is he made the case that, the people are not sovereign, therefore such things as nullification and secession are not legitimate. If you're worried about tyranny, have faith in elections. That's what he said, have faith in elections. That, of course, has not worked out too well. Those are some of the main points about Joseph Story in his famous book, Commentaries on the Constitution. And there's a historian that I quote named Clinton Rossiter, I quote in one of my books, who taught at Cornell for many years. And he makes the point that this book, Commentaries on the Constitution, pretty much educated the northern elite in terms of in legal circles from the 1820s up through the 1860s. And so to the extent that there was a debate over secession and states' rights and so forth prior to the Civil War, the northern side was educated primarily by this book, Commentaries on the Constitution by Joseph Story of Massachusetts. Then there was another man from Massachusetts, Daniel Webster, who got into a famous debate over the nature of the Constitution, the nature of the Union, with Senator Robert Hayne of South Carolina in the 1820s. And this is online, the Webster-Hayne debate is online, it's also published in the big fat book. And he repeated pretty much a lot of the same arguments from Hamilton, Marshall, and Story. Government has the authority to decide the limits of its own powers, he said. Of course, that's not true. The Jeffersonians always warned that if the day ever came that the government itself was the sole arbiter of the limits of its own powers, that it would soon decide that there are no limits on its powers. And that's where Americans are today. He repeated the whole people nonsense. Faith in voting. If you're worried about tyranny, he said, have faith in voting. And so, and that didn't really work, hasn't really worked out too well either, has it? And so, that's another thing that he did. And also, Webster redefined treason in the Webster-Hayne debate. The Constitution itself, Article 3, Section 3, defines treason as only, use the word only, levying war upon the United States, and the word United States is in the plural, or giving aid and comfort to their enemies. And so since the language is all in the plural, not the singular, it's referring to the free, independent, and sovereign states. And treason in the Constitution means levying war against the free, independent, and sovereign states, which, of course, is exactly what Abe Lincoln did when he waged war against the southern states. But Webster redefined treason as opposition to federal government policy. And that's the same definition that Abraham Lincoln adopted during his tenure as president. Opposition to him and his policies was treasonous. And so, but the actual document, you can look it up in Article 3, Section 3, defines treason very differently. It defines it as literally waging war against the people of the states. Okay. And so, so the reason I brought this all up is that this is all a part of the strategy used by, these were the economic nationalists. You cannot separate the political and legal and constitutional efforts from the economic policy. It was all part and parcel of the same game. They understood that the opposition to their economic agenda, economic nationalism, mercantilism, had to be fought in politics and the law. And it eventually was a gun battle during the American Civil War that ended it all. But for many decades, it was a political battle and a battle in the courts over the legality and constitutionality of mercantilism, essentially the so-called American system, and bringing it to the United States. And so these famous men, Daniel Webster, Joseph Story, John Marshall, they really laid the groundwork, the political and legalistic groundwork, for unlimited government that would impose the system of crony capitalism and protectionist tariffs and central banking on America. And then it was all put into place rather violently during the American Civil War, when the chief opposition to all this, Southern politicians, were gone. They left the Union. And even after the war, they were disenfranchised for quite a while. And I'll tell that story in the next class. And so so it finally all came into being during the Lincoln administration. But there was a big fight over it. And it wasn't just these people. There, I mentioned the Jeffersonians. There were economic authors who opposed this. William Leggett, L-E-G-G-E-T-T, for example, a 19th century person. Condi Ragay. So R-A-G-U-E-T is another person. There are several articles about Condi Ragay in the Mises.org, who was a New Englander and an advocate of laissez-faire, an advocate of free banking, free market banking system. And so there was intellectual support during this this period. John Taylor, I mentioned John Taylor, who wrote several really good books opposing all of this in the 1820s. And so it wasn't just these famous politicians that were involved. There was a national movement among the Jeffersonians and then later the Jacksonians, and many of whom were advocates of laissez-faire, as Murray Rothbard has often pointed out in his writings. But they were eventually defeated by the Hamiltonians, and I pinpoint the American Civil War as the point of departure where all this was adopted. But that's next week's class. I wanted to explain all of this, the history of this and some of the economics of this tonight in this class. And so I guess that's about all I wanted to say in terms of the lecture for now. But we'll do what we did last week, and I'll look at the chat and the Q&A and see if there are some questions here that I can answer. Let's see, I see one question about kickbacks. I'll find the the citation here in a second about Daniel Webster and the kickbacks, because I quoted it in my book, The Real Lincoln. Just one second. There's a really good book on Andrew Jackson by Robert Remini, R-E-M-I-N-I. It's just called Andrew Jackson. And he mentions this on page 144 of Andrew Jackson by Robert Remini. He mentions some of this. There's also a biographer named Maurice Baxter, who wrote, his book is entitled Henry Clay and the American System. Henry Clay and the American System. And he says this about Clay. I'll quote him. He says his income from this business. He's talking about Henry Clay after he resigned as Secretary of War and became a lawyer for the Bank of the United States. His income apparently amounted to what he needed to pay off his personal debt. $3,000 a year from the bank as chief counsel, more for appearing in specific cases, and a sizable amount of real estate in Ohio and Kentucky in addition to the cash. When he resigned to become Secretary of State in 1845, he was pleased with his compensation. He's very, very pleased. How nice. And so that's Maurice Baxter, Henry Clay in the American System. And as far as Webster, he wrote a letter to Nicholas Biddle saying this, quote, "I believe my retainer has not been renewed or refreshed as usual. If it wished that my relation to the bank should be continued, it may be well to send me the usual retainer." And that was from Robert Remini's bank, or book, rather, also on Andrew Jackson, page 145. And so that's a couple of places where you can find that. And it's no big secret. Historians have known about this for a long, long time. Let's see, Malcolm Arnold has a question about Jefferson. How do you view his pro-statist acts such as the Louisiana Purchase? Well, Jefferson didn't see it that way. He saw it as widening the empire of liberty. But he was a politician. You have to distinguish, you know, when you're a political philosopher, you can speak your mind. When you're a politician, you have to compromise your principles if you want to succeed as a politician. That's how to explain it. So it's not a matter of I'm not pointing to Jefferson as some sort of perfect human being. We're trying to understand history here. So the fact that he was not a perfect human being is really just irrelevant. He became a politician at one point of his life, and he behaved like a politician. When he was a political philosopher, he behaved differently. Let's see, the question of Malcolm Arnold, why did the Mormons build their own railroads? Well, that's what everybody did. They didn't, the Mormons especially, did not want to rely on the government. The government had been persecuting them. They had no chance of getting money from the government. The government had slaughtered some of the Mormons in the 19th century, as far as that's concerned. And so they did what they always do. You know, to this day, the Mormons have their own welfare system that is many orders of magnitude more successful than any kind of government-run program, where they give people a lot of help, but with strings attached. You have to be pursuing an education. You have to be pursuing a learning a trade. You have to be looking for a job. If you sit back and just collect money from your neighbors, they'll kick you out. They'll stop it. They won't give you any help. And so it's not unusual to think of the Mormons as building their own railroads, which they did. That's how the railroads were mostly built in England at the time, private capital markets. Let's see if there's any Q&A. Also, let's see, I'm going back to this other question about Jefferson. Jefferson didn't, the Sedition Act, Jefferson abolished the Sedition Act. He didn't use the Sedition Act. Let's see, any other questions? Here's Christopher says, was Section 1 of the 14th Amendment put in place to prop up the supremacy of the federal government? While the post-Civil War amendments were very different than all the amendments that had preceded them, and that they added a phrase that allowed the federal government to enforce them. Prior to that, the language of the Constitution was Congress shall make no law, abridging freedom of speech and so forth. But it was the post-Civil War amendments that were different in that they included language that gave the federal government the power. Because after all, they had just fought a war to destroy states' rights and to put in place a system of government whereby the federal government is the sole arbiter of the limit of its own powers, just like Webster and Story wanted to happen. In my book, Thinking Unmasked, I quote Woodrow Wilson writing when he was a professor at Princeton, approvingly, that one consequence of the American Civil War was that the federal government did become the sole arbiter of constitutionality through its own court system, through the Supreme Court. And that, of course, is what the Jeffersonians warned against for decades. Let me see. Let's see, Malcolm Arnold was writing why Albert Gallatin was Jefferson's Treasury Secretary. Well, yeah, Gallatin did write a report advocating government funding of a system of roads and canals. Jefferson himself, though, said, looked at the report and said, well, he's not against building roads and canals, but he said the Constitution would have to first be amended to allow for the use of tax dollars for that purpose. And so, so they didn't do it. Nothing came of it. It was a big, long report. And it wouldn't be the first time or the last time in all of history where a political appointee disagreed with the person on something that, with the person who appointed him. After all, political appointments are often log rolling deals where we'll do this for you if you appoint our man as Treasury Secretary or as whatever. And so, who knows? I don't know the extent to which Gallatin was Jefferson's hand-picked man or it was part of a political deal. You know, we will go along with this legislation, Mr. Jefferson, if you appoint our man, Albert Gallatin, as Treasury Secretary. That's the way it often works in politics. Let's see. Let's see, Christopher Walker says, after looking at today's reading, he noticed that the Confederate government constitution had a prohibition of using tax revenue for internal improvements, which is true. The Confederate constitution outlawed the use of tax dollars for internal improvements. It also outlawed protectionist tariffs. It allowed for a revenue tariff of like 10%, but it specifically outlawed protectionist tariffs. And no, there was no such amendment that would have applied to the U.S. Constitution that I know of prior to the war that existed there. The book on this is The Confederate Constitution of 1861 by Marshall DeRosa. And Marshall DeRosa is a friend of the Mises Institute. He's given quite a few presentations at the Austrian Scholars Conferences over the years. Let's see. I'll look for any more questions here. Let's see, Bob. Let's see. Bob Shaw, I don't have a link. David is asking, any comments from Bastiat regarding Hamilton? From Bastiat, I can't recall off the top of my head if Bastiat mentioned Hamilton or not. He may well have at some point, but I can't recall. Even though I wrote the article that is a book that the Mises Institute published some years ago called 15 Great Austrian Economists. And I wrote the chapter on Bastiat, who was sort of a pre-Austrian economist, but I don't remember running across any commentaries on Hamilton. certainly on protectionist tariffs and things like that, and interventionism, but can't answer that one. See, Bob Shaw is asking, given British mercantilist experience, is there a history of anti-mercantilist writings of any consequence? I'm not sure what that question means, but there's a famous story of how two men named Cobden and Bright, through their writing and speaking, persuaded the British legislature to do away with all tariffs by 1850. And so that would be a consequence of anti-mercantilist writing premised on beginning with the work of Adam Smith and the French physiocrats and Ricardo and Jean Baptiste Say and people of that sort, who were all sort of pre-Austrians in terms of their outlook on economics. But that's how I would answer that question. I have a question about something that John Adams said. I don't know why he would have used that word. So John Adams wrote it. I have no idea. Sorry about that. Let's see if there's anything in the Q&A section here. Malcolm is also asking, he pointed out that during the Lincoln administration, they were losing the war, but they were spending millions of dollars on building a railroad to California. You know, why is that? Was it so that the northeastern states could get access to the newly discovered gold and silver? Well, it was a political payoff. Lincoln was a railroad lawyer. He was not only a railroad lawyer. He was the railroad lawyer in America. He was the man. He represented all the main big railroads of the Midwest. He was offered the job of general counsel of the New York Central Railroad. The railroads bankrolled his campaign. He owed everything to the northern manufacturers, northern banks, and the railroad corporations. That's who supported him. He was their candidate for president. And so this was a payback. He was a masterful politician. And when people of this sort put you into office, the first thing you got to do is pay them back if you want to continue in office, if you want them to continue to support you, and if you want to be reelected. And all politicians want to be reelected. And so it was primarily a payoff. That's what they did. Let's see, have I received any British criticism for my attacks on mercantilism? No, either. Certainly not by anybody with an education. When I'm attacked for criticisms of mercantilism, it's always from some public relations person from some corporation that is receiving benefits from the government. But it's never anyone who has studied economics for a day or two, or even somebody who happens to be British. You know, why would a British person champion the cause of political plunder for the benefit of big business if he or she was not a recipient of the plunder? And so, no, I've never had any criticism there. Let's see, one question, in my view of Hamilton, does he acknowledge any limits on the role of governmental power? Well, he does in the Federalist Papers, but then after that, his actions defy his words, because he became an advocate of unlimited government at the end of his life. And so it leads me to believe that he was lying in the Federalist Papers when he talked about state sovereignty and how the coast. And keep in mind, too, that it's a well-known fact that when they did not adopt his version of the Constitution, which would have had a king, who would appoint all the governors who would have veto power over all state legislation. When they refused to do that, he left the Constitutional Convention, and he condemned the Constitution as a frail and worthless fabric. And so he spoke favorably about constitutional limits as a means of getting this Constitution through the New York legislature, endorse it, and to get the political convention in the state of New York to vote in favor of the Constitution. But he wanted the end result. He wanted that Constitution to be amended or changed through case law to create essentially an unlimited government. There's a question about New Orleans. A lot of statues of Henry Clay in the streets and so forth there. Well, his daughter married a New Orleans native. Why is New Orleans indebted to him? I don't know. I'll make a guess. Henry Clay was a hemp farmer. He once said that the reason why he got into politics was to procure protectionist tariffs on hemp, on foreign hemp, and also to get the government to put up tax money to build roads and canals so that he could bring his hemp from Kentucky to the East Coast. And if I were to look into this, I would find out if he had business connections in New Orleans where he was shipping his hemp out of the port of New Orleans and helped make a lot of people very wealthy in New Orleans. If he would have done that, I would imagine those wealthy people in New Orleans would have gotten their city council or mayor to name a street or two after their benefactor. James, there was no love of slaves by Northerners at all, even the abolitionists. So we'll talk more about this next week when we move up in that period of history, but the abolition societies in the northern states only ever claimed no more than 2% of the adult population. And so there were very, very few real abolitionists in the North in 1861. Abraham Lincoln was not an abolitionist, never called himself one. He distanced himself from them. He made a speech at the Cooper Union in 1860 where he said, "We have abolitionists in Illinois. We shot one yesterday." And so keep that in mind if you ask a question about this. And even a lot of the genuine abolitionists did not care so much about the well-being of the slaves. A lot of them were post-millennialists who believed that government can and should be used to create heaven on earth, so that to eradicate all sin, to create a thousand year kingdom of God on earth, to prepare for the second coming. That's what a post-millennialist is. And a lot of the abolitionists of this time were post-millennialists, and so they looked at slavery as one great sin that had to be ended for their own salvation. Not because they cared about the black strangers in Mississippi, but they thought that they could not be saved unless the sin of slavery was eradicated. And then after the Civil War, slavery was no longer the issue. They became, rum and Romanism became the great sins, that is, the Catholic Church and alcohol. So they became prohibitionists and anti-Catholic bigots. And that these would be progressives. Yeah, by the time you get to the late 19th, early 20th century, they're calling themselves the progressives. Let's see, Christopher is asking, was there attempts to create a third bank in the United States? No, I don't think so. Second Bank of the United States ended in the early 1840s. It was dead. And that was called the free banking era. There was still some government regulation of banking, branch banking restrictions, for example, and there were periodic suspensions of specie payment by Congress. But there was no central bank of any sort. There was no national bank. And even the Lincoln administration did not create a national bank. They created the National Currency Act and the Legal Tender Act. But there was a movement after that to create a central bank, the Fed, and that movement preceded the creation of the Fed by several decades, but it wasn't immediately after the ending of the Second Bank of the United States, as far as I know. Fields. I have a question here. Let's see, well, there's a question about the economic system of the South associated with Jefferson and Jackson. Well, in Jefferson's day, there were slaves in all the states, including New York, Massachusetts, but many orders of magnitude of them were in the southern states. And so that's one historical fact to keep in mind. But the economic system, the economic system of the South was similar to the economic system of the North. There was always some degree of government regulation. There's a book by an economic historian named Jonathan Hughes. It's called The Governmental Habit. It's about how there always has been some degree of government intervention, regulation, and so forth, even from the time of the American colonies. So it's always been a matter of degree. But it was still true that at the outbreak of the American Civil War, the average American paid about $45 a year in tax, and the only contact he or she had with federal government was through the post office. And so government was very limited, and the big intervention in the southern states was the existence of slavery and the non-existence of totally free labor. And there were federal laws, the Fugitive Slave Act, subsidized the system of slavery by forcing northerners to run down runaway slaves and at their expense and return them to their owners. So the federal government subsidized the system of slavery, and that was probably the biggest economic intervention that existed. And of course, since slave labor is inherently less efficient than free labor, this helped to cement into place a grossly inefficient form of agriculture. It also led to the situation of where the South was much slower than the North in adopting manufacturing, because the Fugitive Slave Act and other laws subsidized agriculture so much. Let's see, why was the Republican Party popular in the Midwest in 1860? Well, there was a Yankee belt that spread from New England Yankees, from New England, upper Pennsylvania, and Ohio to the upper Midwest. Not so much the lower Midwest, but the upper Midwest. And if you want to know what the attitudes were of the people who comprised this Yankee belt, look up an article on the web called The Yankee Problem in America by Clyde Wilson. It was on lewrockwell.com some years ago. And so it explains what a Yankee is. In the article, you know, not all Northerners are Yankees. A Yankee is someone who believed in a highly centralized government that could impose its will at whim on other people, essentially, whether it's on economic legislation or any other kind of legislation. And so these were sort of people who are sort of political imperialists. Clyde Wilson, in his article, says that Hillary Clinton today would be a sort of a museum-quality specimen of a Yankee, and they had this type of attitude. And these people had spread to the upper Midwest. They also were advocates of an all-white society. Lincoln himself, for example, was dying day, advocated the deportation of black people. It was called colonization. He was a member of the Illinois Colonization Society. The state of Illinois amended its constitution in 1847 to prohibit black people from entering, from living there. And so the lily white New Englanders wanted to preserve the new territories and the states in the Midwest where they were moving to as all white territories. That's why they supported so-called colonization, and that's why they supported laws and constitutional amendments like Illinois that prohibited the immigration of black people into those states. And so that's why Abraham Lincoln himself, in one of his political speeches when he was running for Senate, said that we want the territories, new territories, to be preserved for free white labor. And that was the upper Midwest. And the Republican Party was their party. That's who it represented. But also, all throughout the Midwest, there were a lot of Jeffersonians who opposed all of this. And they were denigrated and libeled and smeared as copperhead. Copperhead is a form of a snake. So they were called snakes in the grass. And you can read, there's several good books about the Copperheads. One is called Lincoln's Critics by Frank Clement, K-L-E-M-E-N-T. And it gives a history of the Midwestern so-called Copperheads. Yeah, I'm in the chat. Let me see if there's anything else in the Q&A. There's a question here about the founding of Canada. My understanding is Canada was always more centralized. In the late 19th century and early 20th century was a period of centralized government. The Soviet Union was eventually formed. Germany was becoming more and more centralized. That was a trend in this whole period of history. And so in Canada, I think was set up in a much more centralized manner than America, which is not surprising because of the British influence. And so, but I'm not an expert on the history of Canada. Let's get back to the chat here. Any more questions? Going once, going twice. Been here for a while. I'll sit here for a minute or two, see if there's any more questions on the chat. Question about panics in the 19th century. Well, the BUS, the Bank of the United States, caused the panic of 1819, and then when it was defunded, Nicholas Biddle tried to withdraw credit. He tried to punish Americans by withdrawing the availability of credit to the best of his ability at the end. So he created a bit of a panic there. But the government after that, and during that time, had the ability to alter the money supply by one, stimulating the creation of banks with legislation, and then two, passing legislation that would allow for the suspension of specie payment by the banks, so allow these banks to essentially print money at will, or legalize counterfeiting. And so you don't necessarily need to have a bank in the United States or a Fed to expand the money supply. You could do it through the government's legislation that calls for the suspension of specie payment for the next 2 or 3 years, for example. And that did happen from time to time. In terms of this talk about the pietist, read Murray Rothbard's article called World War One as Fulfillment. There's a subtitle to it, but World War One as Fulfillment. He tells the story of the progressives and the link to the post-millennial pietists. Malcolm is asking if the so-called Yankees were involved in social Darwinism and eugenics. Some of them were that I know of, eugenics. Woodrow Wilson was interested in that. Bob Shaw is asking about what Rush saying, 49% of Americans were takers versus givers of government subsidies. Well, this is what John C. Calhoun warned about many, many years ago in his great book, A Disposition on Government. That in a democracy, regardless of the constitution, the tax consumers would outnumber the taxpayers, the net taxpayers, and that certainly is where Americans are today. Other countries got there a lot sooner: England, Greece, France, Canada. I would add, got there a lot sooner. We can recover our independence through secession. That's how we can recover our independence and government on a much vastly smaller scale. If not, I don't think we can. I think that's the only hope. Question, did Jefferson support the deportation of blacks? Jefferson's position was he thought that the fact that the slaves were bottled up mostly in the South was a bad thing, and that freedom would come someday if the population were more dispersed into the territories. I know he had that position. Jefferson also proposed gradual emancipation very early on, 1780s, I think. It went nowhere in Virginia, in the Virginia legislature, but he did propose a law for gradual emancipation. Of course, Jefferson did propose colonization. It's different than talking about Lincoln, because Lincoln is championed as a great racial saint. And so when you point out that he also was in favor of deportation, it sort of punctures that idea that he was a great racial saint. No one has ever accused Jefferson of being described as a great racial saint, and so it wouldn't be shocking or surprising or even interesting, really, to learn that. Let's see. And there's a question about Clay and Calhoun and the bank. Well, Calhoun was a proponent of the War of 1812. And so you'd have to ask Clyde Wilson these questions. He's the expert. He's the editor of the 25 volumes of the collected works of Calhoun. But I suspect since he was a proponent of the War of 1812, then the bank is something that was resurrected to pay for the War of 1812. So that is probably why he was involved with Madison in that. And that was Madison's war, of course. Okay, so I guess Christopher is done. No more questions from him. That's a good point that Matt makes. Canada became more unified in response to invasions from the United States. In the War of 1812, the Americans did attempt to conquer Canada. And so war always leads to a more centralized state. And so maybe the distrust of the Americans led them to adopt a much more centralized state than they otherwise would have. James Blackstone wants to know if any state can secede without another war. I hope so. But who knows? Let's see, Malcolm Arnold asking a question about George Washington and his property. Well, if you read the history books about the Bank of the United States, the one by Robert Remini, Andrew Jackson and the Bank War is the name of the book, and he talks a little bit about this whole history. And also, there are a lot of histories of the great debates between Hamilton and Jefferson over the Bank of the United States. And it was a political deal. Washington knew they were moving the nation's capital, and so if the nation's capital would abut his property would become worth more, become more valuable. And so he told the Federalists from New England, I'll support your bill to create the Bank of the United States if you redraw the map of the nation's capital to be adjacent to my property. And therefore his property became worth a lot more money, and he became a much wealthier man. Okay, people are saying good night, so I guess it's time to say good night for, I guess, 10 of 7. Well, thank you all for attending. I hope you learned a little something tonight again. And I'll see you again next week. We'll get into the era of Hamiltonian hegemony, beginning with the Lincoln administration.